Okay. Okay, last week we started off with the first part of the shiur on Megillas Esther in anticipation of Purim. Next week, this time, Be'ez Hashem will probably be in the midst of trying to fulfill the mitzvah of hearing the Megillah. But this morning I wanted to speak about, to give the second part of the shiur, and to speak about again a few points, mostly from the perspective of the Ibn Ezra and his commentary on Megillas Esther, to point out a few things that are of interest going through the Megillah. We know from way back when we first learned the story, that Esther invites Haman and Ahasuerus twice to a party. At the first party, you know, when Ahasuerus goes to her and says, "Masha elaseh li'nosem loch," why don't you invite me? Obviously, you have something to talk about. What is it that you would like? Esther pushes him off and says, "You know what? I'd like to have a party tomorrow, where you and Haman will come back the second day." And as you know, it's only at the second party that Esther reveals her hand, so to speak, identifies Haman as the one who wants to do damage to the Jewish people, and everything that happens after that, as we know, ensues. After Ibn Ezra, why two parties? For those of us who like parties, we may not appreciate the question. What do you mean? Why not three parties? Why not four parties? But if the intent of Esther was to bring Ahasuerus and Haman to a party, and she felt that that was the best venue for revealing the fact that Haman had designs on destroying the Jewish people, why not simply do it at the first party? Why have this whole idea of coming back a second time to have another party? It's interesting, the Gemara discusses what Esther had in mind in having the venue of the party altogether. Why did she have a party with Ahasuerus and Haman? What was she hoping to do? But the Gemara doesn't discuss explicitly the question as to why it was necessary to have two parties. Ibn Ezra offers up a very interesting explanation. He writes, "L'fi daiti, in my opinion, she'ichara Esther l'dader v'yom harishon v'mishrei hayayim." Esther was reluctant to speak to Ahasuerus directly on that first day and to reveal that Haman was plotting against the Jewish people. "Ba'avur shelo rasa shum os, shechidesh Hashem ba'avur tainis Yisrael." The Jewish people had been fasting for a number of days, close to 3 days at that point. And says Esther, "I would expect that there should be some heavenly sign that our prayers have been answered before knowing that it's the right time for the Yeshua, for the salvation. I haven't yet seen that sign. And since I haven't seen that heavenly sign," says Esther to herself, "I feel that it's premature. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for whatever reason, you know, is not ready to bring about the downfall of Haman. So that," she says, "come back a second day and we'll have another party." And the implication of the Ibn Ezra is, had Esther not seen anything take place between the first party and the second party, she would have had a third party, and she would have kept having parties until she saw some kind of heavenly sign. But what happened? Between party number one and party number two, it's the whole incident described in Perek Vav of the Megillah, where Ahasuerus has insomnia, where Haman ends up leading Mordechai through the streets of Shushan on the royal horse, and says that Ibn Ezra, Esther saw all of that, and she saw that not just as, a cute way of getting back at Haman, but in her mind she said, "This is a sign from the Ribbono Shel Olam that things are beginning to turn in our favor, that things are looking up, that our prayers are beginning to be answered. That's the sign that I'm waiting for, and that now gives me the green light to reveal that Haman is the one who's plotting against the Jewish people and wants to bring about our downfall." Right? So it's the fact that in the chapter of Ibn Ezra, essentially, you know, I think the takeaway from this Ibn Ezra is that when a person, again, I don't know if you want to send it backwards to both people like you and me, but certainly in a situation like Esther and Mordechai, when the entire Jewish people is davening on behalf of some kind of salvation, it is appropriate to look for these divine signs to try to figure out when the tide is turning in our favor. That's what prompted Esther to feel the time is right to be able to reveal the fact that it's Haman who's plotting against the Jewish people. Very, very fascinating stuff. Let's move on a little bit. Again, we're just picking out various thoughts. So, we referenced before Perek Vav, where Haman ends up leading Mordecai through the streets of Shushan, which has a very, very famous, this story. So Haman comes back home all defeated, and the Pasuk says, "Vayisaper Haman b'Zeresh Yisrael l'chol ohavav et kol asher karahu." Haman told his wife Zeresh and all of his friends everything that had happened to him. "Vayamu lo hakamav b'Zeresh Yisrael," and his wise friends and his wise men said to him together with Zeresh, and here the Ibn Ezra sticks in a comment, which is just such a sharp comment, what happened to his friends? He came home, he told his friends and Zeresh everything that had happened to him, and all of a sudden, who speaks back to Haman? Chachamot, his wise advisors, and his wife Zeresh. What happened to his friends? Oh, Havon. So comments to Ibn Ezra, the Vo Eid HaRasha, when it looks like the Rasha is going down, well, Yisnablu Ohavav Allah's Tov. His friends all of a sudden have nothing good to say about him. He came home and he spoke to his friends. You know, oh, a funny thing happened to me today in the streets of Shushan. I was running through the streets of Shushan. I was leading Mordecai through the streets of Shushan on the royal horse. You know, my blood is on garbage on my head, the whole thing. He tells all of his friends. And all of a sudden, by a few words later, he doesn't have any of those friends anymore. His friends are entirely quiet. You know, they are fair weather friends. In the fullest sense of the word. What's that? Right, that's also true. What the Chachamim and Zeresh actually say is very fascinating and also, you know, calls for some explanation. They say, the Pasuk says that they say to Haman as follows, "In Mizera HaYehudim Mordechai, Asher HaKilosa Rimpolifonov Lo Sukhalilor, Kinofolti Polifonov." If from the seed of the Jews is Mordechai, that which you began to fall before him, you will not be able to vanquish him, you will continue to fall before him. Right? So what does that mean? So, again, on a very, very simple level, you know, these Chachamim, these great friends, great advisors of Haman and his wife, are telling him, you know, if it's going down, it's going down. You know, if you started falling before Mordechai, it's all downhill from here, which indeed, you know, is pretty much a good description of what happened. You know, this was the beginning of the end. But the introductory words which introduced this phrase are very, very striking. Here he said, Yehudim Mordechai. If Mordechai is from the seed of the Jews, so then, once you've begun to fall, you're going to continue falling. What do you mean if Mordechai is from the seed of the Jews? If Mordechai is Jewish, you all know that Mordechai is Jewish. The whole basis of the story up until this point has been that Mordechai is Jewish. Right? And it says so explicitly in the Megillah. Haman, when Mordechai refuses to bow to him, gets angry at Mordechai and his entire people, wants to destroy the Jews. Why? Because the prophet says, "He did Lahem, Asher Hu Yehudi," because Mordechai had already revealed that he was Jewish. So everybody knows that Mordechai is Jewish. What do you mean, "In Mizera HaYehudim Mordechai"? If Mordechai comes from the seed of the Jewish people. So here, there are a number of different mafashim try to explain what's going on over here. One version of the commentary of the Ibn Ezra writes that the way to understand this phrase is as follows. We know that Mordechai is Jewish, but is he a descendant of those Jews who were responsible for the death of Agag, the king of Amalek, back in the time of Shaul HaMelech? Right? We know that he's Jewish, but is he from that particular strain of the Jewish people? Because if he's from that particular strain of the Jewish people who has a track record in annihilating Amalek, so we know that, you know, that's a bad sign for you. We know he's Jewish, but it's just not sure which part of the Jewish people he's from. There's a fascinating alternative explanation which is brought here from Rabbi Victor Cohen Sedek. I mentioned him last time in the Shir as well, also one of the medieval commentators. And he interprets the Pasuk as follows. In Mizera HaYehudim Esther, Says Rav Avig, the Kohen Tzedek, insert the word Esther into the pasuk, and the whole thing makes sense. Esther's identity, as we know, is a question mark at this point in the Megillah. Nobody other than Mordechai knows that Esther is Jewish. But at this point in time, Zeresh and the Chachamim, who are connected to Haman, begin to have a glimmer that something might be up with Esther. There's something strange about her that, you know, we can't put everything together. And they say as follows, in Yizera HaYehudim, Esther, if Esther is from the seed of the Jews, if our suspicions are correct that Esther is actually Jewish, and there's a Jewish person in such a high place of power in the government, Kamo, so then Mordechai, Asher Achilosa, the Paul of Honor, Moshuchalo, concerning Mordechai, that you've now begun to fall before Mordechai, you will certainly not be able to overcome and to overpower Mordechai. If Esther, who's in such a position of power, is Jewish, that curtains. You know, it's all basically over from here. Again, a very, very fascinating interpretation to, you know, for what's a strange and difficult process. There are two comments that the Ibn Ezra makes in the Megillas Esther, which are both very similar to one another, and they both concern a trend in Chazal to try to equate two biblical characters one with another. I fast forward a little bit to Parak Zion, and Parak Zion, of course, is where Esther reveals that Haman is looking to kill her and the entire Jewish people. And who is the hero who comes in at the end of the day and leads to Haman being hanged on the tree? Charbono. Right, here comes Charbono. Vayomer, Parak Zion calls it test. Vayomer Charbono, Echaz bin Asolisim, Lufay HaMelech, Charbono, one of the eunuchs who served before the king, said to the king, Gam hinei yoeit, asher ofta Haman l'mordechai, asher diber tovar HaMelech, omer b'dei Haman, gavar chamishim amah. Wouldn't you know it, Haman built a gallows 50 cubits high to hang Mordechai upon it. Vayomer HaMelech, Tzluhu Allah, says the king, hang Mordechai on that very, very same gallows. Who is Charbono? So, Ibn Ezra writes the following. Divrei Yochid, ki Charbono hu Eliyahu zichrono lebracha. Says the Ibn Ezra, there is an opinion, he describes it as a minority opinion, but there is an opinion in Chazal that Charbono is none other than Eliyahu HaNavi. Right? What's that? It's interesting, right. Yeah. Maybe Zal means Zachar Latov, the truth is. Right. Yeah, that would make more sense. Right. Right. Right, so Charbono is Eliyahu Zocher Latov. That right, it probably is. That probably is the correct, correct meaning of the Rashi Tevos. And here, the Ibn Ezra is quoting a Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer. We mentioned last week the Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer is one of the earliest midrashim that we have. So the Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer identifies Charbono with Eliyahu. The Ibn Ezra clearly holds that that's not the majority opinion, but then he goes on to write his follows. Well, the Fee Daiti, in my opinion, Shatan, the reason, or what Chazal has in mind when they say that Charbono is actually Eliyahu, is not literally that Charbono and Eliyahu are the same person. But rather, Shizeh HaSolis, this eunuch, Charbono, who are mitkar b'tchilat ha-sefer, kihumi ha-shiva ha-sarisim. He's mentioned, after all, in the very beginning of Megillas Esther as being one of the seven servants or eunuchs who served Ahasuerus. This eunuch also tova li Yisrael. He did something good for the Jewish people. Uva'a ha-Yeshua al Yodo. And the salvation of the Jewish people came about through Charbono. Charbono is responsible for Haman being hanged. Ki ilu Eliyahu zofer la-tov ha-ya. So, says the Ibn Ezra, what Chazal means by saying that Charbono is Eliyahu, is that Charbono plays the same role that we anticipate Eliyahu playing before the coming of Moshiach. We know that Eliyahu is supposed to come before Moshiach's Tekenu comes. So it's not that Harbono was actually Eliyahu, says it's an Ezra, but Harbono played an Eliyahu-like role, and as such, it's appropriate. That's what Chazal has in mind, he says, when Chazal say that Eliyahu and Harbono are one and the same person. Harbono was acting, as it were, as a type of Eliyahu. It's interesting to note that Ibn Ezra takes a very similar approach back in Perek Daled of the Megillah, where we also find an identification of two characters, one with another. The Megillah of Perek Daled makes reference to one of the servants of Esther, whose name was Hatzah. So, who is this Hatzah? So say, we mentioned last week that there's some discussion about who Hatzah was exactly. Chazal understands that Hatzah is Daniel. So the Ibn Ezra over there says, I have a hard time understanding this statement of Chazal that Hatzah is Daniel. We know that Daniel was second in command in the Babylonian Empire. He was a wise man. His counsel was sought after by kings. And if you look at the Megillah's description of Hatzah, he's basically what we call nowadays, he was a gopher. You know, he's running back and forth between Esther and Mordechai and giving a message. So if Hatzah was really Daniel, he would think that he wouldn't just be running back and forth between Mordechai and Esther with telegrams. He would be part of the consulting team to try to figure out how to deal with this tragedy, you know, that a decree has been promulgated against the Jewish people. So I don't understand what it means to Hatzah is Daniel. Says to Ibn Ezra, I'll tell you what I think it means. Hatzah is Hatzah, he's not Daniel. But Daniel was such a loyal servant that Hatzah is described as Daniel to accentuate his loyalty and his faithfulness as a servant. So this is very similar to what Ibn Ezra is saying over here, and it's a very interesting approach to understanding a phenomenon which is very common in Chazal, where Chazal will say, you know, this person is really that person, this person is really that person. So Ibn Ezra is suggesting, at least in these two cases, Chazal don't always mean that literally, that person A is really person B, because oftentimes, you know, that identification of person A and person B is hard to figure out. You know, there are a lot of details which don't always make sense if you say person A and person B are the same person. So Ibn Ezra, what Chazal means by that is that person A exhibits some of the qualities or the characteristics of person B, so that person B, since we know a lot about person B, we can use the model of person B to better understand something about person A. Harbona is really Harbona. So we understand Harbona's important role by comparing him to Eliyahu. And Hatzah is really Hatzah. But we understand some of the faithfulness and the loyalty of Hatzah by comparing him to Daniel. That seems to be the Ibn Ezra's approach to these statements from Chazal. Okay. Here is a very interesting Ibn Ezra later on in Perek Ches. So Haman has been hanged. And, the show moves on, and Achashverosh goes to Mordechai and Esther and says, you know, what now that Haman has been hanged, what would you like further? What else would you like? So, Teretz Pasuk Hey, Esther says, Vatomer, Im Al HaMelech Tov, Im Atzot Yichei Lufanov, Vachashir HaZavon, Vatnei HaMelech Vatavon, Ani Ve'inov, if it should please you. Please rescind the order of Haman to kill the entire Jewish people. A reasonable request, you know, coming from Esther and Mordechai. Meaning, Haman has been hanged in Nisan. There's still another 11 months till Adar, till the 13th of Adar, when the entire Jewish people is supposed to be annihilated. And even though Haman has been killed, the decree is still on the books. So Esther goes to Ahasuerus and says, please rescind the decree. What is the response of Ahasuerus? So he says, Pasuk Ches, Vatem kitzu al ha-Yehudim katov ve'enechem b'shem ha-Melech. As for you, write concerning the Jews whatever you want in the name of the king, the chislu, the tabayat, sign it with the king's seal, Because everything written by the king, in the king's name and signed with the king's seal can never be rescinded. Okay, so I would think the response of Mordechai and Esther would be that they can send out a second set of letters rescinding the original decree. But what do they do? What they actually do is they write in Pesuk Yalef, Asher Notan HaMelech LaYehudim Asher B'chol Ir Bo'ir V'Hikonel V'Lamod HaRashom V'Hashmid V'Larod V'Ladeiv Kol Fil Am V'Medina HaZarim Oshom Pat V'Noshim V'Shvalom Lovos. The Jews throughout the 127 provinces have the right to gather together to fight against their enemies, to destroy them, and to take their property. If the Ibn Ezra, I don't get it. Why don't they just rescind the decree? Say that nothing is going to happen on the 13th of Adar. Why, it seems almost bloodthirsty to give the Jews, you know, to make a new decree that says the Jews now have the right to fight against their enemies, annihilate them, and take all of their spoils. You may say, okay, they had it coming to them, but wouldn't it be easier and, you know, in a certain sense, nicer things just to be, just to send out a second set of letters rescinding the original decree? So the Ibn Ezra suggests as follows. Says to Ibn Ezra, the key to understanding this is something which the Megillah says in passing, but is not 100%, you know, obviously what the, you know, obvious when you go through the Megillah. The king tells Mordechai and Esther, once a decree has been made, it cannot be rescinded at all. Which means that Haman's original decree to kill the Jews on the 13th of Adar can never be taken back again. And Ibn Ezra references the story of Daniel and the lion's den. Right? There in Sefer Daniel, you know that the king Dariush is convinced to make a decree that anyone who prays for 30 days to any deity other than the king of Persia is going to be thrown into the lion's den. Daniel is caught praying, and the king is incredibly praying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the king, of course, has a tremendous love for Daniel and doesn't want to see Daniel hurt in any way. But the king, Dariush, basically says, look, what can I do? Once a decree has been sealed and signed by the king, it can't ever be taken back. So reluctantly, the king has to allow Daniel to be thrown into the den of lions, where he, you know, would have met his fate, you know, were it not for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's miraculous intervention. So says Ibn Ezra, we see from that story how once, apparently in Persian law, once a decree was put into place, it could never be rescinded. So there is no way to take back the decree to kill the Jews on the 13th of Adar. So says the king, but I have an etzah. I have a piece of advice. Maybe we could do as follows. Why don't you write all of the 127 provinces the following? Of course there was a decree concerning the Jews that would take place and that would be actualized on the 13th of Adar. However, what the decree really was that the Jews would have the right to rise up against their enemies. That was the real decree. But the evil Haman, and we see that he was an evil Haman because he was just 10, the evil Haman changed the original decree. He falsified the papers, the documents, so as to create the impression that the decree was that the Jews should be killed. Now we're just restoring the original decree, namely that the Jews would have the right to rise up against their own enemies. So this says to Ibn Ezra, the fascinating chap, this was a subterfuge. Because the only way that you could protect the Jews without rescinding the original decree was to claim that the original decree had been misrepresented by Haman. Haman got his hands into everything and changed what the original decree was supposed to be. The real original decree was that the Jews should be able to rise up against their enemies and not vice versa. Right? But that's what Ibn Ezra says. Otherwise, why would they do that? Why wouldn't they just say, leave well enough alone? Cancel the 13th of Adar, a day to kill the Jews? No, 13th of Adar is just kind of a party, you know? It's nothing on the calendar. Why do they have to transform it from a day you know, in which the Jews are supposed to be killed, to a day in which the Jews are given the right to rise up against their own enemies. It says to Ibn Ezra, again, that was the only way they could do this legally, because of the strange Persian law, that you could never rescind an original decree once it was signed and sealed by the king himself. That's his interesting take on this idea. The Ibn Ezra also references a custom which, to the best of my knowledge, does not exist today, but apparently during the Middle Ages was a common custom that was utilized when reading the Megillah. So later on, in Perek Tes, Pasuk Chaf Zayin, the Pasuk says, Kimu the Kibu HaYerudim Alem Yalzayon, the Jews accepted upon themselves and upon their children, Al-Koram Yerudim Alem, they accepted upon anyone who would come and join them, in other words, anyone who would convert and join the Jewish people subsequently, V'lo Ya'avor, it will never pass, Yos Osin Eshtei HaYomim HaElatich Savav V'chiz Manom. The Jews accepted upon themselves to celebrate these 2 days, the 14th and 15th of Adar, as they were written, Tich Savam, the Chiz Manam, and in their proper times, B'chol Shana B'Shana, year in and year out. What's Tich Savam, right, as it was written, right, to Ibn Ezra, Hata'am Shetikore HaMegillah, right, what the Pasuk means, you know, to observe the holiday of Purim as written is to have the Megillah read year in and year out. And then he says the following. Ba'avur she'ezra ha-sofer hitzit ha-psukim v'hu ha-yo akar shalim rabos sivu ha-koneinu zau shlo yisok ha-korei v'sok ha-posuk. There's different versions of what the Ibn Ezra actually says over here. The Ibn Ezra is quoted differently in different sources. But let's give at least one version of what the Ibn Ezra might be saying over here. Says the Ibn Ezra, it was Ezra HaSofer who decided when the psukim would end. In other words, when he edited certain svarim of Tanakh, it was Ezra who decided where the sof pasuk, where the end of each pasuk would be. And in the case of the Megillah, the Chachamim, our sages, said, Shlo Yisok HaKorei B'Sok HaPosuk, that when the person is reading the Megillah, he should not stop at the end of each Pasuk. What does that mean? What's he talking about? So apparently there was a custom in the Middle Ages that when the Baal Korei would read the Megillah on Purim, he would not stop at the end of each Pasuk, as we do, I think, universally today, but he would just keep reading the whole Megillah, you know, just as one long run-on sentence, essentially. Right, there was no self-pasuk at the end of each of the psukim. And Ibn Ezra seems to be defending that practice. Again, some of the discussion within the different versions of the Ibn Ezra is Ibn Ezra defending that practice, or is he decrying that practice? But one way or the other, he's certainly mentioning that practice, a practice to not stop at the end of each of the psukim. So let's talk about that custom. I guess in certain cases it would. Again, usually from context you can figure out when the end of a pasuk would be, even if you don't actually stop, right? But it is a very funny sort of thing. Why would there be a custom to read the Megillah as a run-on sentence, right? I mean, I guess in the Kalkari, I suppose, for that, at some point. Yeah, right, but he would just pause whenever he would run out of breath, right? So there would be no attention paid to the end of Sukkim or the like. So, you know, that's a very interesting custom. Why would you have a custom to not, you know, pause at the end of Sukkim the way we do, you know, whenever we read from the Sefer Torah? I thought that perhaps this might come back to an idea which the Gemara speaks about. The Gemara points out that, the Gemara Megillah points out, that Megillah's Esther is referred to in the Megillah itself as an igeres, as a letter. And for that reason, actually, if you look, when the Megillah is laying the shul, the Megillah is not held like a scroll, you know, the way that a Sefer Torah is, where it's, you know, rolled up at both ends. The Megillah is folded over, you know, many, many times, and read as if one was reading a letter. Perhaps the idea of reading the Megillah in an unconventional fashion, reading the Megillah in such a way so that one would not stop at the end of Sukkot, but just kind of read it as a run-on sentence, and, you know, stop whenever you just need it to take a breath, is to accentuate the idea of reading the Megillah as a letter. When you read something formally as a scroll, so it's read with a certain formality. Part of that formality is stopping at the end of every pasuk. But when you read something as a letter is meant to be read in an informal fashion. And part of the way that this custom accentuated the informality of reading the Megillah was to not stop at the end of Sukkot and kind of read it, you know, without all of the formalism which we normally have when we have the Kriyas HaTorah. What's the idea of reading the Megillah as a letter? You know, what do you mean we read it as a letter? Right, but you know, again, let's put it in the contemporary, you know, if we were going to give this shiur in 2017, which we are. What's that? Right, so all the other Megillahs are arranged like regular Sfarim, you know? So it's not the Megillah Esther, which is read as a letter. So let's put this in contemporary terms, right? Let's say that you were reading Megillah Esther as a text, right? With emojis and all these sort of things in the middle, right? Meaning what? Meaning that, you know, people don't write letters anymore, right? But in other words, a text, an email, or something like that, there's a certain informality that you would never use, or hopefully you wouldn't use, if you were writing an essay, you know, to submit to a journal or something like that. You know, that the word you is spelled Y-O-U, as opposed to just writing a U, you know, or, you know, smile, or something like that, right? So the idea of reading the Megillah as Megeres, you know, is the 2,000-year-old version of reading it as an email or a text or something like that. There's a certain informality. And the same way that in an email or a text, I'm not so careful about punctuation because I'm just trying to get an idea across and the punctuation doesn't matter so much. So by the same token, reading the Megillah as Megeres as a letter, I'm not so careful about the punctuation. I don't have to stop at the end of every pasuk. Okay, what's the idea behind that? Why would Chazal want, you know, us to read the Megillah in an informal fashion as an Egeres? I think the idea behind it is that Chazal wanted to stress that we should see the Megillah not as some record of ancient events, but we should feel like it's very contemporary and like it's speaking to us, you know, in our own day and age. By definition, you know, a text, and not a real text, not a text, you know, in other words, a book, an essay, an article, there's a certain permanence to these things, but there's also a certain, you know, older quality to a book or to an article, to an essay or the like. There's a certain contemporary quality that a text or an email has. It may be raw, but it's also very, very fresh. And when we read the Megillah, we want to feel that somebody, you know, that the story is being communicated to us in a very, very, you know, in real time, so to speak. We're supposed to feel that it's something which is being conveyed to us in a contemporary fashion, and by playing down the formality of how we read the Megillah, that very contemporary, very fresh aspect of absorbing the message of the Megillah is brought out. So again, we don't have this minhag, we don't have this custom that the Ezra references, this idea of reading the Megillah is just as one run-on sentence, you know, just pausing whenever you need to take a breath. But I think the idea behind it, you know, is an idea which is, you know, still very, very relevant and ties into this idea of the Megillah being in the Garris. Finally, one last thing from the Ibn Ezra, which I think is very fascinating and very contemporary. So Peretz, you know, goes on and speaks at length that how Mordechai and Esther essentially set up the holiday of Purim for the Jewish people, and describes all of the laws of Purim and how they're supposed to be observed. And then at the very end of Peretz in Pasuk Chavches, you have the following Pasuk. But Kiptov Esther Hamalkovat Avichai Lo Mordechai HaYehudi is called Tokif. Esther the queen and Mordechai the Jew wrote called Tokif. They wrote about all of the strength and the reinforcement that was necessary. And what strength, what reinforcement? L'chayim es igeret ha'purim hazot ha'shenis. To uphold and to fulfill this second letter of Purim. So what's that referring to? There's a second letter of Purim, you know, besides the first letter of Purim, that was written by Mordechai and Esther, and it's involved with the idea of tokes, of strength and reinforcement. So what does that mean? So the Ibn Ezra writes as follows. Shomru Yisrael zos ha-mitzvah v'achar kach not shuha. This pasuk tells us, says the Ibn Ezra, that in the initial years after the story of Purim, the Jews accepted the holiday upon themselves and they kept it, and they read the Megillah and they said Shlach Manos, and they, you know, they did all these wonderful things. And then a few years after that initial Purim, the Jewish people stopped keeping Purim. Okay, no more Purim. And for that reason, Al Kain Hutzrach Mordechai should tichtov Esther, va'avur heyoso malka, et kol tokev kimo chosek. It was in response to that that this pasuk came along, because basically Mordechai and Esther looked at the Jewish people and they said, wait a minute, they stopped keeping Purim. This is unacceptable. Mordechai knew that if Mordechai himself was to write to the Jewish people, hey, what happened to Purim? Apparently he felt that he would not be strong enough to have an impact on the Jewish people, so he tapped Esther. Because he said the people will listen to Esther over Mordechai. Why would they listen to Esther? Because she was the queen, says the Ibn Ezra. So that's what the pasuk means. But Tichtov Esther HaMalka, the first one who wrote the letter, the first signature, was Esther the queen. Queen Esther. Right? She wrote, together with Mordechai, Mordechai was under her name, as called Tokef, stressing and reinforcing. In other words, a letter went out a few years after the initial Purim, signed by Queen Esther and Mordechai. Hey guys, what happened to the holiday of Purim? This wasn't just a couple of years that you guys were supposed to keep Purim. You're supposed to keep Purim Lazare Doros for all the future generations. We insist, as Paul Tokev, with all the strength, we insist that you start keeping Purim again, and this time don't let it fall by the wayside. That's the Igeret HaPurim Hazos HaShemis, the second letter of Purim, which went out to the entire Jewish people. This wasn't a one-time observance, a two-time observance. This is an observance forever and ever. So that's it.
Which you don't believe. You mean seven
of them. I guess either we're reading the second one, it's just an addendum that was stuck on at the end. In other words, it was important. When did it become part of Tanakh? Perhaps it became part of Tanakh, you know, let's say 5 years, 10 years after the original event, and at that time, you know, the Megillah already had this addendum added onto it that, you know, a few years after the original event, Mordechai and Esther had to write back to the Jewish people. We weren't just kidding, this wasn't just a one-time event, you know, keep Purim forever and ever, right? It's a fascinating idea, a little bit of a disturbing idea. Who would want to get rid of Purim? I mean, you know. Okay, so that I understand, right? All the people who are getting, you know, like tons and tons of hamantash and said, wait a minute, you know, let's just move it back to Shvat, move it back to Tavis, make it in the first Hazor, right? So, okay, maybe that was the incentive to get rid of Purim. But all seriousness, why did they drop Purim? Purim's such a wonderful holiday. And these were Jews who just a few years before appreciated, you know, that they had been saved from the clutches of Haman. Mordechai was still alive. Esther was still alive. Why on earth would they stop celebrating Purim to the point where Esther had to write back and say, no, this is for all future generations, and wasn't just a one-time event? I would suggest the following. Again, if I'm correct, I think that the lesson is perhaps eerily contemporary. The Jews observed Purim that first year or two or three to mark the fact that they had been saved from the clutches of Haman. But after that, anti-Semitism seemed to have disappeared. I mean, the truth is, if you look in the history of the Persian Empire, with the exception of the story of Haman, the Persians were extraordinarily benevolent to the Jewish people. They let the Jewish people go and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. A few years after the story of Haman, the Jews were allowed to finish building the Beit HaMikdash and been temporarily put on hold. And the sense you get was the Jews were pretty comfortable in the Persian Empire. So a few years after that initial Purim, the Jews basically got together and they said, okay, that was a blip on the screen of history, but now we're comfortable here. We're not really comfortable with the holiday of Purim about, you know, anti-Semites, they want to destroy us. That's not our experience. It was our experience 3 years ago. Okay, that was done. A lot changes in 3 years. Now we know that, you know, everybody is our friend, everybody loves us, and, you know, anti-Semitism is a thing of the past, and we need not even have a holiday to even remotely reference the fact that, you know, somebody could have wanted to destroy the entire Jewish people. A few years after the original events of Purim, the Jews decided, you know, this holiday and its themes don't speak to us anymore. Comes Esther and Mordechai write to the entire Jewish people, and they say, you're fooling yourself. You think that was the last episode of anti-Semitism? You think this is never going to happen again? You know, my dear children, this is a holiday that you need to have on the Jewish calendar. Perhaps specifically, when you feel that everything is good and everything is wonderful and you have nothing to worry about, don't worry. I mean, unfortunately, there are going to be many, many times in the future where anti-Semitic despots are going to try to destroy the Jewish people. And you'll need to be able to draw on the holiday of Purim for chizuk, you know, for inspiration. And, you know, it's not just a holiday of yesteryear, it's a holiday which has an eternal significance. And, of course, we know that, you know, again, if that interpretation of events is correct, you know, Mordechai and Esther were right on target. You know, that the events of Haman and Purim were certainly not to be last time by a long shot. That Omdim Aleinu L'Chamoseinu, that there was an attempt to annihilate the Jewish people, is a recurring theme throughout Jewish history. And having the example of the holiday of Purim, that those who rise up against us ultimately are destroyed, and ultimately we put our trust in the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, is not just a holiday describing events that took place many, many years ago, but has been a recurring theme of Jewish history, you know, throughout our very, very long Golos. All right. You want to wish everybody a Selach and Purim. Of course, next week we will not be meeting, you know, in light of the fact that it's Purim. But we will kick off the following Sunday, and we'll get started already with talking about that word, which begins with the Tay, ends with the Ches, and describes that holiday that comes right after Purim.